when you look at the overall geopolitical strategy of the Trump administration, and you see what they're doing in Syria, in Yemen, helping Saudi Arabia, all of their movements right now are all geared toward surrounding Iran and starting to beat the drums of war against Iran. Where they polled Israeli citizens, and something like 60% of Israelis support the idea of forcibly removing the Palestinians, all Palestinians, from the territory, from the Israeli territory. They don't want to intermingle. They don't want to have a one state. Either Americans don't know any of this is happening, or they don't care. At worst, they support it. And I think, what happened to the morality of the American people, the ethics of America, the understanding of the basic concepts of right and wrong? I would love to see a lot of these people go down and send the message that that will kind of revitalize the American people into believing again, into having hope again. Yes, we can get some control of our government back. That's my hope.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we're bringing back Jake Morfonius. He is just an excellent investigative journalist, and he's been looking at the Las Vegas stuff. He looks at geopolitical situations. He's been covering the Israel situation. He is just an excellent, excellent journalist. He one of the best I've seen out there. And what he does is he looks at facts, very objective with his reporting, and brings things to light. If you are one side or the other, you don't lean towards his politics, which you can see a little bit what his politics are, there's still so much value listening to him because he brings in so much information. He's always coming at it from what is right and what is wrong, which I absolutely love. And I would really welcome anybody in any side of the political spectrum to listen to his information. I came upon him back with the Las Vegas investigative reporting that he was doing. He was the number one reported news source on the internet. He outdid all mass media combined. And that's when I found him and I interviewed him about that. And he's just a great person. So what we do is we cover the Israel situation, what his beliefs are and what he's found about that, with Trump naming Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and us moving our embassy there, or talk of moving our embassy there, and what he thinks of all that. We also dive into his coverage of Las Vegas and his coverage of YouTube and the pedophile rings that are flourishing on YouTube. And then we get into different topics as well. And he's so gracious, and he answers a question about what he's learned about the Bohemian Grove for my Patreon. So if you are a Patreon, please go to Sarah Westall under Patreon, Patreon.com/Sarah Westall, and you can see that video there as well. So I want to thank you for being a Patreon, and I do have a couple of my books up there and mini videos now for Patreons. They're short, extra questions that people are answering for me, so it's a nice little bonus for people. I will eventually start to roll them out to the public, some of them, but for a good period of time, then we'll be exclusive for Patreons. So let's get into my interview now with Jake Morfonius.
Hi, Jake. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Sarah. It's really nice to talk with you.
Yeah, well, I love talking to you. You are one of the best investigators, period, out there. You are just very objective, no nonsense, fact-based, and I absolutely love it. I can trust what you say because I know you've done this due diligence behind the scenes, and that I absolutely love. Because there isn't a lot of that out there right now and in any media. So I'm just so thankful that you're around.
Thank you.
Well, let's get started. There's all sorts of stuff to talk about. And I know these are some of the, I'm not sure all these topics you've dived into, but I think most of them. And I wanted to ask you first, what do you think of the latest move by Trump naming Jerusalem as the capital of Israel?
Oh, pretty controversial, huh? I mean, that's really, I don't want to say shocking, but it is, disclaimer, I didn't vote for Donald Trump. I support a good number of things that he's tried to do, the pulling out of TPP, some things like that. But when it comes to foreign policy, I just don't align with President Trump on many things. And this, the recognition of Jerusalem could have been handled differently. If he really wanted to do this, I think there could have been a softer approach, a different way of easing into it. But I actually think that this was intended to do it this way because it's provocative. And I think the goal here was to provoke. The two-state solution has been kept alive, I think, far longer than really it should have been. I think the Palestinians and the members of the Arab League, those that support the Palestinians, I think that they have recognized for quite a while now that the whole Israeli-Palestinian peace process is kind of a sham. There were problems, of course, back when Yasser Arafat was leading the PLO. He was not extremely cooperative. However, really when it came down to it, the problem always came down to the status of Jerusalem, because the Palestinians always said in the peace process, yes, you're offering us all these many things that we like, but you can't take Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, from us. And that's always been the crux of it. And so knowing that Israel was never going to agree to those terms, to fully give over East Jerusalem to the Palestinians for their state, the whole idea of a two-state solution just was never going to be viable. They're not going to give that up. And so we see more and more people in recent years, even among the Palestinians, acknowledging that really at this point, a one-state solution is probably their best option. And in a sense, what President Trump did is really just acknowledging the state of how things are, that the peace process, Israel's never going to give it over. But when you look at the overall geopolitical strategy of the Trump administration, and you see what they're doing in Syria, in Yemen, helping Saudi Arabia, all of their movements right now are all geared toward surrounding Iran and starting to beat the drums of war against Iran. Iran has funded Hamas. They have sent support to the West Bank and Gaza. They, of course, support Hezbollah, the Shiite militia in Lebanon that is fighting in Syria along with the Syrian Arab Army. And Iran has also supported the Houthis down in Yemen, that are kind of, they're like a branch of Shia Islam. And so everywhere that you have Iran taking action to provide support to help keep the parties they like propped up, we have the Trump administration moving in and supporting the other side. And that's one of the reasons why we have, when President Trump took office, one of his first foreign policy actions was to get in there and throw a lot of support behind Crown Prince Salman's war against the, really it's a war against the civilian population in Yemen. We saw Trump go over with Jared Kushner, paving the way to set up this huge arms deal, you know, multi-billion dollar arms deal, biggest arms deal in world history, selling weapons to the Saudis. And of course, everyone knows that we're joined at the hip with Israel, politically speaking. And so what Trump did by recognizing Jerusalem was, he's smarter than this. You could not have not anticipated what was going to happen. There was going to be violence. There was going to be an outbreak. There was going to be summits held by some of the Arab nations. All of this was going to happen. The question is, did Donald Trump not know this was going to happen? Did he not care? Or did he care but had a purpose in it? And I believe the latter is the answer. I think that this is all part of that effort to get into a war with Iran. That's who the globalists, the oil corporations, the bankers, Iran right now is at the top of the list. Everything we were doing in Syria, that was really just a backdoor way of trying to get into war with Iran because of their military pact and the support that they have. But by recognizing Jerusalem, here's what happens. Without question, it's just completely predictable. We have and will continue to have violent responses by Hamas over in Gaza. Israel is going to crack down in response to that with airstrikes and things of that nature. There will be rockets that get popped off from Gaza. There already have been some, but that'll continue. What is going to happen, I believe, is that Israel is going to say, hey, Iran is providing funding to Hamas. Iran is providing funding to the Lebanese Hezbollah, which is fighting in Syria. And so that means Iran is at war with us. We've seen this recently from Saudi Arabia accusing both Lebanon and they're accusing everybody over there of Qatar as well. You guys have declared war on us by your, you know, these benign actions they've taken. So I think Israel's going to do the same thing and set up this justification for war with Iran. The problem is Israel and Saudi Arabia, despite being regional powers and Israel having nuclear weapons, they don't have big enough forces to have a conventional war against Iran. They're not just going to go out and suddenly have a nuclear strike against Iran. That's not going to happen. So you have to have ground forces for this battle. And really, the Middle East, it's all a proxy battle between you've got Iran on one side, Israel on the other, and that's what's going on. Saudi Arabia has joined up with Israel geopolitically. They're very closely connected now. There's a nexus, kind of a new, someone called it an axis of goodness. I wouldn't call it that. I think they were just juxtaposing that against the axis of evil idea. But this new axis of goodness is Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, Jerusalem, and New York City. And they're working together, collaborating to go after Iran. So by provoking this, the for sure we know that this was something that Benjamin Netanyahu wanted. He wanted justification to start becoming more militant. He's having all kinds of problems himself there, corruption probes and so forth. So there's all kinds of reasons to try and do this. Jared Kushner, the whole Kushner family, super closely tied to Benjamin Netanyahu, personal friends. Netanyahu has stayed at the home of the Kushners a number of times in the past. So that connection to the Trump administration, you can't tell me that there wasn't some connection there between Benjamin Netanyahu and the Trump administration through Kushner, trying to bring about mutually beneficial goals. Recognizing Jerusalem serves that purpose. It's provoking Hamas. It's provoking or justifying a response by Israel. I believe that Israel is going to ramp up airstrikes against the Syrian Arab army around Damascus. I think that they're going to eventually start striking Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they're certainly going to increase their activity against Hamas in Gaza. And this recognition of Jerusalem is really kind of the flashpoint. That's what has kicked all of this off. So we're going to see this over the next handful of months as this plays out. It's going to get ugly.
I've been following some Muslim scholars, activists, and one of the things that sticks out to me is when this whole thing went down, I was hearing that this was actually, it's a game-changing event, but in kind of a weird way, it was a positive move because the two-state solution was always a farce and a front for being able to act like you were doing something behind the scenes, doing something else. So to the world, you were acting like you were trying to do a two-state solution while you were doing a lot of violence and other things behind the scenes. And so, the concept was, well, now at least they're putting their stuff, their cards on the table, and they're telling the world what they're trying to achieve. And so in that way, it's at least there, it's no more games. You know, this is what we're doing. Let's just go
right
for it.
Right. Yeah, I agree completely. At this point, with the United States recognizing a unified Jerusalem, that essentially kills the prospects. It does one of two things. It either kills the prospects of a two-state solution, or it removes the United States completely from the peace negotiation process, because we've now declared ourselves to be staunchly pro-Israel in this whole process, and there can't be neutrality. We can't be a neutral mediator. You're not going to have photos of President Trump with the Palestinian-Israeli leaders on either side shaking hands. Instead, what you would have is President Trump with his arm around one side, pointing the finger at the other. And so it won't work. So in a way, yes, this does have the potential for a positive development, because now that we can openly say, all right, the two-state solution is no longer viable, now we can talk about the one-state solution. Problem is, the Israelis are never going to go along with that. Never, 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 because Palestinians are they're the majority. If they become, if they become a one state with voting rights, it's no longer a Jewish state, and the Zionists are not going to give up the concept of a Jewish state. In fact, Pew Research polls came out last year, I think it was, where they polled Israeli citizens, and something like 60% of Israelis support the idea of forcibly removing the Palestinians, all Palestinians, from the territory, from the Israeli territory. They don't want to intermingle. They don't want to have a one state, because they know that if this happens, suddenly, it's a 50-50 split as far as the internal politics goes. They're going to lose a lot of power.
And I think that's what the deal is. At least you got past this illusion, and now we can start talking about moving forward. They had, and what I'm reading, they don't see it as positive. the whole Muslim community is outraged right now, and just outraged in general. Do you think that a war will eventually break out, or will it keep being what it is, kind of like this slow burn war where it's never escalates quite to a world war, but we're always fighting?
It depends on how hard they go after Iran. What if it weren't for the Iran factor, then yes, it would continue to be a slow burn. What we would most likely see, for example, should things that are happening now in between Israel and the Palestinians, if this were to continue, turn into, say, a third intifada uprising by the Palestinians, then what we would see is probably a repeat of like the 2014 incursion into Gaza, where Israel slaughtered a few thousand Palestinian civilians in they bombed them, used white phosphorus, all kinds of things. And of course, the Palestinians were shooting their rockets off into Israeli territory. But Netanyahu knew, he always keeps his finger to the wind. There was a lot of international condemnation, and he knew how much they could get away with. And they finally backed off. And you just reset and get ready for the next round, which will pop up in a couple years from then, where you just keep decimating territory among the Palestinian Authority. And then after you've bulldozed everything and build some new Jewish settlements, then it belongs to Israel. You give it a couple years and repeat the process until you gradually just hem in the Palestinians into a smaller and smaller territory, gradually taking the land. The problem, though, is that there are competing geopolitical goals right now. Israel certainly has its own goals there with the Palestinians, but they've got ambitions to have greater control in the entire region. The U.S., of course, supports that because we work in tandem with Israel. What really changed was after the debacle of the Iraq war. It's not like with Libya, where we went in and destroyed it, and there weren't a whole lot of outside powers outside of Libya that rushed in to try and take control of the vacuum that was created. But in the case of Iraq, when we obliterated their government and installed a weak, watered-down puppet government, suddenly there's a great power vacuum. Someone's got to fill it. Is it going to be the United States? Well, it makes sense that the next greatest regional power, Iran, is going to be the one to try and exert its influence, especially considering that Iraq after Iran, it's got the next greatest concentration of Shia Muslims in the entire Middle East. So yes, Iran is doing just what we do. It's kind of like the Monroe Doctrine for the Middle East. This is our sphere of influence. You know, with the Monroe Doctrine says North America, South America, it's closed off to European colonization. You guys stay on your side of the Atlantic, we'll stay on ours. And if you come over here making trouble, we're going to consider that meddling with the United States. So we understand that. That's our political doctrine. We just don't allow that for the Middle East. Iran is trying to exert the same kind of geopolitical Monroe Doctrine. They're trying to say this is our region. In the absence of Iraq, without that strong player, we are going to start to exert our influence for our own purposes. And that's something that Israel doesn't want. Saudi Arabia doesn't want it. And so with them closely allied to the United States, and to an extent they own the U.S. political system, that's why we're going to see the goals of going after Iran overtaking what would be a kind of a smaller conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Netanyahu would probably like to keep it confined to just a small territorial war if possible, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think that the international bankers, they are doing so much right now, not only in the Middle East, but North Africa. We've got Sudan, Somalia, where the CIA and just thousands of paramilitary contractors, Blackwater-type mercenaries working for the oil corporations, they're in there causing all kinds of trouble, lots of fighting going on, drone strikes. So these oil corporations are pushing really hard to expand right now. They're emboldened. They believe that with Donald Trump in office, they're going to be able to get away with a lot more than they have in the past. Obama was kind of favored the Iranians to an extent. I think that was evident in the deal that he made with them. But there's just too much going on. Those in power, and I'm talking about the bankers and the oil corporations, they are in expansion mode, and you cannot expand without creating friction. Genie Oil is taking over more and more of the Golan Heights, which is why Israel is going to keep pounding the Syrian army to keep them away from that area. So it's going to continue to get big. And I think that there is potential here for it to happen relatively soon. By soon, I mean by the end of Trump's first administration, his first term, because he wants to be remembered. He wants a legacy.
He campaigned on, you know, America first and against the globalists, but the globalists are just completely surging international under him. So was his campaign not real, or is he focusing on the trade-off is we're going to strengthen the United States and I'll let you do what you want internationally? I mean, what is he?
I take Donald Trump at his word when he said after winning the presidency, he had campaigned the entire time saying, you know, I'm a nationalist, I'm not into the globalism stuff. But after he won, he came right out and it was widely quoted where he said, I'm a globalist and a nationalist. And I believe that he actually means that, in that there are some things about globalism that he supports, especially when it comes to capitalist profit with the oil corporations and so forth. But he's more nationalist when it comes to domestic politics. He doesn't want the globalists having as much influence inside the United States and what we do inside the country. But you, in my mind, you really can't have it both ways. You're one or the other. You're nationalist or you're globalist. You can't say, I support nationalism for our domestic policy and I support globalism for our foreign policy. But I think that's what it is. This dichotomy is, I think it's something new we've not seen. In the past, we've just had a string of globalist-oriented puppets in the White House, and we've got Donald Trump, who's a mixture of the two. He's staunchly globalist when it comes to a lot of the foreign policy, despite what he said. Remember, he said, let's get out of Syria. He was very critical of Obama over the years for Obama's intervention in Syria. He said, let's bring the troops out. We don't need to be there. And yet, his very first opportunity, he goes and launches dozens of cruise missiles at Syria. So go figure.
Well, I'm not sure how much control a president really has, honestly, but, you know,
virtually none.
Yeah,
when it comes to foreign policy, virtually none.
So maybe he can. Go ahead.
I was going to say that the question is, I mean, that's a very good point, and I talk about that a lot when I discuss this on my channel, that U.S. presidents have their figure, largely figureheads, and when it comes to foreign policy, they have virtually no control. The bureaucracy that is under the influence of the Council on Foreign Relations, the U.S. State Department, they kind of do this regardless of what the president wants. The CIA certainly doesn't take orders from the president. They do what they want. And so the presidents are usually just kind of trying to stay relevant, keep themselves involved. So with Donald Trump, though, he could take a stand against this. Maybe it's not the safest thing to do. We look and see what JFK did when he started trying to dismantle the CIA after the botched Bay of Pigs. We saw what happened to him. Maybe President Trump understands that there's only so much he can do. But my opinion is, if you take the oath of office to preserve, protect, and defend the U.S. Constitution, don't run for the office. Don't take the oath of office unless you're willing to take that chance, to risk your life for the good of your countrymen. And so regardless of whether or not the system kind of moves on without him, I want to see him do what he said he was going to do. I want to see him get out there and fight these people and say, no, we are not going to get involved in some senseless, purposeless war with Iran. We're not going to be joining in with Saudi Arabia against Yemen, which we're doing. Instead of pulling back all these things since he took office, we've had a great expansion of CIA operations. We've had a great expansion of U.S. military presence around the world. I mean, look at North Korea there, the Korean Peninsula. The military interventionism has just expanded greatly, and he could do something about it. So some people will try and give him a pass and say, well, really not his fault, but you know what? Get out of the way if you can't do something about it. If you're not willing to try, or if you can't try to do it for whatever reason, for the good of the country, let someone else get in there and do it. So I've got feelings both ways. I really respect Donald Trump in some ways, and in some ways, he makes me want to pull my hair out.
Well, we just don't even follow the just war theory. You know, we're aggressive. It's really hard to watch us do this. But do you think that at the end of the day, is this all about central banks being in Iran?
I think that that is what got us launched in that direction, whether or not it ends up being the central bankers are still trying to take over Iran. But it's more than that, because it's not just about having the central banks in there. It's that they are the financiers of the major oil corporations. You've got the Rockefellers, you've got the Rothschilds, and they are very, very active right now in trying to take control of regional oil resources. The Rothschilds right now are Nathan Rothschild, Jacob Rothschild. They are very much involved in the expansion of the political power of Qatar, or they had been, into Sudan and Somalia to take control of the oil, because the Qatari Investment Authority, the QIA, which is kind of like the government run, what they use to invest in, that's completely controlled by Oh, which oil company is it? Can't remember off the top of my head, but it's one of the Rothschild oil corporations where they've got majority interest in it. Qatar basically owns this oil corporation, so it's about the central banks, but it's in the end it's not just power, it's money, and the bankers make a certain amount of money, but one of the primary ways they do it is through their investments in like the oil corporations and so forth. So while we want to get into Iran for the central banking, at the same time we want to take control of their oil resources
What
that
happens
for profit.
when they control the whole world? Then what? They're going to lose their ability to make money. Is that when we go into space and all sorts of other? That's
It'll just be the next thing, whatever the next thing is.
okay. So I mean, because they're getting close.
We are quickly move. I think that we had been inching toward the next world war, slow little moves, but in the last since 2014 there have been some major lurches toward World War III. The mess in Syria, I mean, when we had in the same airspace US fighter jets and Russian fighter jets zipping past each other shooting each other's enemies, the potential for massive combustion there, thank goodness it didn't work out that way. We do have some de-escalation, but really it's only because Putin had the upper hand for a while, but at this point the United States has the upper hand. We don't talk a lot about it, but the original goal was to get in there and overthrow Bashar al-Assad, install a puppet, and basically control the whole nation. But it's not that we want all of Syria. Really, it's about control of their oil resources, and the oil's in two locations. It's down in the Golan Heights, which Israel has controlled. They've occupied that since 1967. The other is up in the northeast region, and right now the United States has control of that. We've got the Russians on one side of the Euphrates. The USA is up there with its proxies, and we're just sitting there. And really, aside from direct warfare, it's unlikely that there's going to be much change there. And I think that's one reason why Russia has finally acknowledged that it's okay to start pulling some troops out, because at this point, what are you going to do? They kind of can claim victory because they kept Bashar al-Assad in power, but at the same time, the economy is crippled and will continue to collapse there in Syria if they can't regain control of their own oil fields again. So it's a big it's it just it's going to keep going. This is not over.
It's just so amazing that we can go in and just take over somebody's resources. We want what you have, so we're just going to go take it.
Right. I am so disappointed in the American people. I love my country. I love my people. But either Americans don't know any of this is happening, or they don't care. At worst, they support it. And I think, what happened to the morality of the American people, the ethics of America, the understanding of the basic concepts of right and wrong? We can we, since when is it okay for us to use the U.S. military on behalf of oil corporations to go in, slaughter civilians, take control of another country's oil when they didn't do anything to us, and that's okay. I just don't understand. I'm a person who does believe in God, and that our actions do merit some kind of response. And if we are apathetic, or if we support things that are just outright evil, outright wrong, I don't think that we're going to have the providence of God, the protection of God over our nation anymore. And we're going to see more things like terrorist attacks inside the United States, and a gradual sinking. Eventually, this huge bubble that we're in, that the Trump administration takes credit for, that's going to pop. The Federal Reserve is going to keep incrementally raising these interest rates until we get to a saturation point. And people are going to lose confidence. All of this economic boom, it's psychology. It's consumer psychology. And once people get to the point where they're afraid again, because the stock market is so overvalued. We're going to have that massive correction that's going to dwarf the 2008 correction, and it's going to be bad for us. So I think that all of these things are partly a result of the general demise of the morality of the American people, or at least the civic patriotism and duty of the American people. We seem to be so consumed with entertainment and Netflix and everything on the phones, and we're not looking around us anymore at what our own government is doing around the world. We've become an empire, and it's like the American people are disconnected from our government. We're like, oh, we can't do anything about it, so we'll just let them do whatever. And so we've got more and more, as each year passes, greater control by the oil corporations, the different multinationals, the bankers, over our political process. And we are becoming like it's like the watching Star Wars. It's like the rise of the Galactic Empire or the resurgence of the Roman Empire. And empires always fall. They reach a point of decadence, and I'm afraid that we're heading in that direction rather quickly.
Well, the stock market hasn't had a correction, really. I mean, since 2008, it's just been going up.
Right.
So that historically, it's just not possible. I mean, so I don't even know what's going on. I don't give anybody advice on that because I'm like, I don't know. Right? Because nothing makes sense.
Everybody acknowledges it. Everybody out there knows that it's a bubble. All of the financial pundits on CNBC and the different money channels, they all know it's a huge bubble. Everything is overvalued. The real estate market has become overvalued again, maybe not to the extent that it was. We're watching the strange things happening with cryptocurrency, and it's bizarre. Like we no longer are operating in the reality that we used to. Stock market's always been kind of a psychology, but it used to be based on the basic idea of you invest money in a company that you think is financially viable, has a good business plan, and that they are going to return a profit, and you're going to earn money as a result of their growth. And if they're not, then you sell your stock if you think they're making bad choices. And you get your money out of it. And the company will then decide, people are pulling out. What do we do? But what's happening and has been happening since 2008 is the investment bankers, it's just speculation. It's a huge speculative bubble where it's built up, and we don't have the manufacturing in America is essentially dead. I am very glad to see Donald Trump putting effort into bringing jobs back to the country, the revitalization of different industries, but it may be too little too late. We've got this huge bubble. If there was some way to do a controlled deflation of this bubble, but I don't think it's possible. I think it's like when you blow up a balloon, it's so tight, you're blowing it and you're just waiting for it to pop in your face. That's where we're at. It's not going to take much to pop it.
Yeah, and well, the question is it just hyperinflation that we're seeing too? You know, some of that in there. I don't know. I do know that the tech sector is really booming. That one is, and that's a positive thing for the country. But I don't know. It's weird. So let's get into Las Vegas, which is something that you're an expert on. You've been spending a lot of time on that. Yeah. What a bizarre situation there.
Yeah, that's been the main thing that I've worked on the last couple of months is the Las Vegas investigation. And I've really had so many people come forward with information. Some of it I put out, some of it I sit on. I just don't release to the public because it's either put someone in jeopardy or I haven't been able yet to fully vet it. But I can tell you that in the last 2 months, I've been able to gather enough information, enough witness testimonies, cell phone footage, all kinds of things, to where I don't have the least bit of doubt, none whatsoever, that there were multiple agents at work in this operation. It wasn't just Stephen Paddock. So many people witnessed this. It's that strange activity. We've got the police scanner audio where we can hear all the things going on. I've got videos of so many different things. And I've actually spoken with several of the Las Vegas PD, six of them. This was in early October, and even they were telling me then, kind of off the record, they didn't want their names attributed, But their sentiment was that there were multiple people involved in the operation. But they said once the FBI took over, which was pretty quickly, the idea of pursuing a multiple gunman theory was immediately squelched. The FBI did not want that looked into. And when the FBI doesn't want you looking into something, most likely the FBI has something, some involvement or something to hide for a fellow agency like the ATF, for example. But really where I've gotten – one of the big routes that I've taken in this investigation is looking into Stephen Paddock's history. And as part of the investigation, I was able to link Stephen Paddock through vehicle sales and co-ownership of some vehicles to a man named Adam Katchke from Caliente, Nevada, who was he's in prison right now. He owned a pharmacy, and he was defrauding the government and other parties to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, mostly selling ketamines. Ketamine is a it was used by veterinarians as a anesthetic, but it's also used in rave parties as a date rape drug or as a hallucinogenic. You know, it's on the street, it's called Special K. So this pharmacist was making millions and millions of dollars in profit. And Stephen Paddock was, they co-owned a vehicle together despite living 7 hours apart from each other. It was just a Nissan Xterra, you know, kind of a nondescript, nothing significant about it. But then Stephen Paddock later also sold another car to the man, which was transferred to their pharmacy manager, also a woman who was also in prison after they got busted for these crimes. And so I've been interviewing people who knew these guys, because beyond that, there was something else that happened around this time, or more recently, where there was a huge bombing in this tiny, tiny little town of Panaca, where a guy drove up, banged on the door, told the mother and three little girls that were there, "I'm getting ready to blow up your house, and if you want to live, you need to get out. I've listened to the 911 call. It's very intense." And that's what he does. He backs his car up to the house. He takes one homemade explosive inside, lights the fuse, comes back out to the car, lights another fuse, shoots himself in the head with a gun, and then the two bombs go off and blow up obliterate the house. The next door neighbor was the brother of Adam Katchke, and the guy who set off the bomb was someone who had been fired from the local hospital that the Katchke's pharmacy was kind of the sole provider of medicine to. So there's this whole ring of illegal drug sales. The guy that the bomber was fired partly for bad behavior with drugs. He got caught with messing around with some of their drugs. Well, Stephen Paddock is tied to all this. What that means, I can't say for certain. Was he a crooked asset working for the DEA? Was he running guns for the ATF? Was he an FBI asset? Somehow he's linked to one of these three agencies. I've got his rental car records that someone passed to me, where I'm looking at his movements, looking into it. There was a certain corridor that he used to drive that was down near the Mexican border, along a corridor where Mexican drug cartels trafficked different kinds of drugs into the United States, including ketamine. So we're getting closer, making some progress there with the investigation. And I keep talking about it publicly because it's one of those things where you don't know how. At best, the FBI would come give me a gag order and say, "Stop talking about this." I'm hoping that's as bad as it gets. But given the history of my cars getting tires slashed and things like that, I don't know if it's connected to that. But it's kind of a surreal, spooky feeling, because you really do feel like you're in some kind of jeopardy. You try and balance that with, am I being paranoid? How much of this is just paranoia? Because I don't want to become one of those weirdos that, tinfoil hat and the government's out to get me. But at the same time, when, like with my case here, with all of the destruction to problems with my cars and someone shooting a gun off outside my house real late one night, it's, suddenly the paranoia really kicks in.
Well, it's just so strange because it's like they don't even care anymore that everybody knows that there's something weird and they're lying to us. It's like they're not even trying.
Yeah,
So
they don't even try.
what has been the reaction of people that you've talked to and listeners and things when it comes to Las Vegas? I mean, is it pretty much my same thing I'm saying here? Is that what the heck? It's just another thing like 9/11 where they're showing their brazen disrespect for the American people.
Yeah, the American people overwhelmingly know that the Las Vegas shooting was not the work of a single lone gunman with no motivation, just some gambler who decided to snap and go shoot people. I mean, that's just so ridiculously stupid. Nobody believes that out there. Maybe people who are completely disconnected from, from other people's opinions, or I don't know, but the American people, I think it's the problem that I see is this has happened so much. People are getting, again, apathetic. There's a malaise, a feeling of we can't do anything about it, so why try? And that to me is concerning. On the other extreme, you've got some people who say, well, the answer is clearly we've got to have a revolution, and some people talk about arming up, and that's exactly what the FBI wants. They want that. They're very, very embedded in the FBI has got assets all over the place inside the Patriot community in the United States, the various militias. I know individuals right now who I know with absolute certainty are FBI assets that are operating freely among some of these militias, trying to set them up, trying to get their dirt on them, and so I don't know. It's where do we go from here? That's I share with the rest of the American people the same concern. What can we do about it? The problem is so big, and they're so brazen, and they don't care. And if you don't like it, they do like they do to people like Dwight and Stephen Hammond out there in Oregon, where oh, we'll throw you in prison, and when you get out, we'll just turn around and throw you back in prison again.
Gosh, it's like we have to follow the Martin Luther King and the Gandhi example, where we have to be extremely diligent but nonviolent. We just
Right.
have we have to really persist, and we have to come together in a nonviolent way. That I think that's the only way that we have a chance. Otherwise, I think it'll be a slaughter.
There's just no way, and I think that I tell this as I go around sometimes. I get invited from time to time to speak to militia groups, come give a speech because of my connection with the Bundy and Finicum, everything that happened out there in Bunkerville and Oregon. And I try and remind them, look at how successful you guys were there in Oregon. You went out to the Malheur Refuge, had all these people, had plenty of weapons, and yet the FBI, as soon as the FBI came in, they shot one person. They shot Lavoie Finicum, arrested Ammon Bundy and his brother and some others. And as soon as that happened, what happened to all of the tough talkers, the militia members out at the refuge? They fled. I mean, they fled so fast, they dropped their guns they didn't even take with them to get out of there because they believed the FBI was moving in on them. That's because just the government's resources so vastly outmatch what we have ourselves. It's not going to be hard for them. Plus, if they don't kill you, they'll put you in prison, or they'll hold you there like they've done to the Bundys for 2 years with no charges, with no guilty verdict. How do you spend 2 years in prison and that be a fair and speedy trial, and you've not been found guilty of anything? It's just ridiculous. So people are afraid of the government.
Well, and rightfully so right now. That's why I'm saying persistent, very persistent and aggressive in a nonviolent way to come together and say, this is not okay.
I am so proud of Lavoie Finicum's wife, his widow Jeanette, and her daughters, their whole family. The Finicums are doing just that. They have been relentless, going out, giving speeches and talking and doing interviews, but making that very point that yes, we have all constitutional rights. Yes, they're worth fighting for, but this is not that time. this is the time for peaceful resistance. We need to be outspoken. And I even told this to Cliven Bundy before he was arrested. I was out there and we were together for LaVoy Finnegan's funeral. I was in a room with about 20 different leaders of these various militias. And they were talking, what do we do? And there were some pretty extreme ideas in the group. And Cliven was the kind of moderating voice. He, you know, he wasn't the least bit interested in anything that would be violent. But his strategy was to go out there and kind of pick a fight in a way with the government over the holdouts that were left at the refuge, the last four people there. Just go out and protest and just be a presence there. And I said, Cliven, we need you so bad out here as a figurehead. You know, they've got your sons. LaVoy's gone. They're decapitating the leadership. And if you go out there to Oregon and have direct, any kind of direct conflict with these people, even if it's totally peaceful, they're going to pick you up and put you in jail under some bogus charge. And that's exactly what they did. They decided to arrest him. And that really caused a lot of this patriot effort to fizzle out. There was a great citizens movement underway that Ammon was leading. And his big thing was education. Teach, teach, teach. Talk about the principles. Have peaceful resistance. Very much like you're saying with the movement there in India. Strength in numbers. If we stand together, even if it's in a peaceful way, there's so much that we can accomplish. When I was out there, I was like, look, guys, we don't need the guns, because there were some people that were talking crazy. And in fact, one of the people in that meeting that was talking about getting violent was an FBI asset. He's not been outed yet. But this guy was trying to get the group to go in and have a gunfight with the FBI to exfiltrate these four people. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, it was so intense. They almost had a gunfight there inside because there was one person saying, no, we're not going to do that. That's ridiculous. The FBI asset kept saying, no, we are going to do it. We need to do this. And I'll be the leader if you want. I'll lead the way. And these guys got into a shouting match. And I'm sitting there literally looking around the room at where I'm going to dive because I thought it was that intense. But we don't need that. Cliven was against that. Ammon is completely against that. All of the people have to understand we cannot just stand up to the government at this point with our, AR-15s or whatever and expect to beat them. That's not how it works. And we saw that with Oregon. The people knew they were no match. The strength comes through peaceful resistance.
Well, what happens is you have peaceful resistance in numbers, and then they do something stupid, like become violent right. with you. And that's where you get everybody to turn. That's right. how it's happened all through history. If you try to fight them on their terms, you're going to lose because then everybody right. sees you as thugs. But once people see you as great, peaceful protesters, and then they see the violence against you, that's where you get the minds and the souls of the general public. And then the government ends up being toast overall. That's where it's the whole war turns. And that's how it's happened all through history. But you have to have strong leaders and you have to be dedicated to it. And it has to get way beyond just the militias and the patriot movement. It has to get right. broad.
Yeah, I couldn't get them to understand that guys, we have you're kind of among your own community. Everything makes sense. But for most of America looking in, people don't have you don't have the most positive PR going on here. You know, we need people on our side. We have to have a vast network of like-minded people, overlapping interests where something brings us all together. Democrats, Republicans,
exactly.
all of us have things. We need to be able to come together and link arms for the good of America. That's what should unite us.
And the good of the world.
Concepts. Right, right. Because once our government gets out of control, we become the bane of – we go around doing terrible things around the world.
Well, let's talk about another subject that you've really dove into lately. And I just thought it was absolutely remarkable. And unfortunately, YouTube took it down. That was the pedophilia report you did
Oh, yeah.
showing. I can't believe, they were probably embarrassed, number one, but you showed how those networks were flourishing on YouTube, and YouTube doesn't do anything about it. Yet, the people who are trying to take down pedophilia, although YouTube has really backed off on those people now, and I don't know if it has to do with what you've been doing or what, but my stuff on pedophilia, they might demonetize it initially, and then immediately they lift off the demonetization, demonetizing it. They bring back the monetization. But yours was striked and removed. Did they put it back
Yeah.
up? What is the deal, and what was the reaction from all that?
So I've covered pedophilia for a good while now on my channel for a couple years, talking about child trafficking rings and things like that. But back during the summer, I did a three-part series on how pedophile rings are flourishing on YouTube. And I went through, it was about an hour long, all three segments together. And I walked the viewer through exactly how the pedophiles do it, showing how they find each other, how they establish various playlists, and how the YouTube algorithm reinforces that and creates kind of in the sidebar after you watch a video, or on the side, you've got recommended videos. And I showed how the YouTube algorithm provided more pedophile content to these people. And you go through the comments and look at what people are saying, and it's all they're all pedophiles. The few people who were participating in these discussions in the comment sections that weren't pedophiles were the ones saying, "You people are all pedophiles." I mean, it was gruesome, the how sexually explicit some of these pedophiles were talking about raping these children in the comment sections. And so, for example, somebody would part of it is you've got different groups who would post, they would take videos that in other circumstances might be innocent. A mother taking her daughter to the beach, and the girl is a little girl, 5, 6 year old, not wearing a top, just wearing panties or a bathing suit bottom, a bikini bottom, playing in the sand, getting in the water, coming out, laying down on the beach towel, things like that. I understand that in some cultures that's no big deal. But the problem is when you look and see that it's not one video, but video after video after video of that kind of content. Well, what I showed in this video was that some of the people uploading these videos were engaging in comments, getting the viewers, the pedophiles, to message them directly, privately, so that they could ex send them more of the children that were in these videos.
And I'm
Literally,
sure it
there were.
was a little bit more explicit than what they saw there.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, and so I did a video about this. I put it was well within community standards, didn't violate any community standard, and so I put all three segments up. I put originally in the summer posted them separately. I figured if YouTube had a problem with one, they'd demonetize one segment, but maybe the others would be okay. And they had to do a manual review of all three, but YouTube manually reviewed all three segments and decided that they were okay. So what I did was, about a month or so ago, is I took those three segments and I just linked them together into a single video and did just a 2-minute introduction, telling the viewer, a little bit about what was going to be in it, and I reposted it. That way, so I've gotten a In the last couple of months since the Vegas thing, I've had a huge influx of subscribers. So I wanted them to be able to see this material. So YouTube gave me a community standard strike and they deleted the video. They said that it was harassment and bullying, was the generic thing
Towards
for it.
them.
And I went back and forth with towards the, well, they didn't say who, right, it was
Well,
bullying
I
them, but
mean.
they. I mean, real. I was bullying them by, if you call, pointing out what they're doing to be bullying. That'd be like, bullying a criminal because you say, "Hey, look, that guy just robbed the bank." Oh, you're bullying him. You're accusing him of robbing a bank. Well, yeah, he did just rob the bank. Well, that's bullying. You're making fun of him. You're trying to make him feel uncomfortable. Yeah, but that's what it was. Nothing. The fact that they had previously we manually viewed the three segments and said all three are okay, and then to turn around and hit it and give me a strike, took away my live stream ability, so I can't live stream on the channel and stuff like that. had I not gotten two previous strikes reversed, that one would have shut down my channel. That would have been the end of my channel for about a year. I wouldn't have been able to post. So the thing is, they had to have known that things were in the works, because not long after this, the Times of London put out a damning expose on this very topic, pedophilia on YouTube and how YouTube's algorithm was promoting pedophile content and enlarging the pedophile community. And some of the things in this article, they didn't quote from me directly, but I mean, there are things right,
it was clear.
Specific examples right from my stuff in this article. Well, as a result of that Times of London article, some major sponsors pulled out of YouTube. Adidas and a couple others pulled their funding and said, if you're going to do this YouTube, you know, if you're not going to do anything about the pedophiles, then we're not going to advertise. So YouTube started to take a little action, but then the New York Post followed up with their own article saying that YouTube's got a huge pedophile problem. And so it's started to snowball, and we're still seeing it play out. But at least one of the immediate things that YouTube did was they deleted over 150,000 videos of the kind of content that we were talking about.
Oh, that's
excellent. I don't want to suggest there's lots of different people that can be credited with working on this. I'm certainly not the only one, but the community of us working against this, it felt like a victory. At least one victory.
When your thing got shut down, I think everybody it went viral. You know, I'm hoping it did. I mean, I think it did. And then the backlash, it just wasn't acceptable. And so I think it was a lot of stuff people didn't realize before.
The number one, I got so many comments from parents saying, I had no idea. I just had no idea that this kind of thing existed and that it was so easy, that it was so prevalent on YouTube. It's not that this is happening it's a scourge. It's like the Black Plague spreading. It's extremely contagious. It just is growing and growing and growing on YouTube. And they knew about it. They knew about it. And they wouldn't do anything about it. That's what is so troubling, is that they were treating the pedophiles kind of like you would imagine, maybe a far leftist who's like, oh, yeah, we need to protect them because it's just pedophilia is just, should be a sexually, a protected sexual class, or too much empathy for the pedophiles. Oh, these poor pedophiles, they're suffering, and we should treat them like, whether it's transgenders or gays, give them equal protection. And that's just I draw the line with pedophilia.
There's a strong line there. So how do you know that YouTube knew about it?
Because YouTube, the whole adpocalypse thing. Well, they knew about it partly because we flagged hundreds of videos. Throughout that year, I had been telling my viewers over and over and over, despite it being a stated YouTube policy that any videos flagged for sexual content, especially anything related to children, would be reviewed and removed. So I had been doing this for a long time, flagging these pedophile videos. YouTube would do nothing. And there were actual channels where they made no secret. Like the name of the channel would be Baby Love, and it'd have a picture of a baby, and then the description of the channel would be something sexual, talking about pedophilia. And so we'd report that. So what I started doing is having my audience, I'd put up some of it and say, try it. Try and see what happens. And so I'd have dozens and dozens of people on each video, at least dozens, flag certain videos or certain dirty comments, just outright talking about child rape comments, and YouTube wouldn't remove it. So beyond that, when you look at how YouTube responded after the November election, the whole adpocalypse, they knew how to use the algorithms to immediately go in and add channels like mine to a blacklist. They created so many different algorithms that followed, that tracked certain kinds of content. A lot of people don't know this, but when you upload a video, the video is processed by YouTube system before it goes out to the public. And YouTube system scans the audio file and it listens to everything that is said in that. And it doesn't matter if you don't add a title or tags or anything. I tested this. I took a video that was, I tested it different ways to see if it worked. And in some of them I had like, you know, puppies and tags about flowers, but the content of what I was saying was talking about, you know, the pedophiles or something. So despite the meta tags and everything, YouTube system can detect the content of what's in there. Their algorithms are designed to take what they find and either make it publicly available to a lot of people or to restrict it. So if YouTube system can do that to censor either Christian views, conservative views, certain political views, then they can certainly do that with people searching for pedophilia. And they wouldn't do it. We tried and tried and tried to get them to do something and they wouldn't do it.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, if they can do it on our videos, because I've had videos that were getting just exploding, 3,500 an hour, you know, people watching it. And then all of a sudden, bam, it's down to 200. Yeah. It just doesn't make sense. And it's because it's the content they don't want out there. And so if they can do it with that, they can definitely do it with pedophilia stuff. Well, and some of those videos seem pretty innocent. It's just the comments that come afterwards, and they should be able to scan that stuff as well.
Yeah, that's the other thing. A lot of the videos were innocent. They were parents putting up things, you know, kids' birthday parties, or the daughter laying on her bed just reading a book or something. And a lot of it are kids themselves that are not intending to produce something that. But what happens is the pedophiles come along and they add videos that are stimulating in one way or another to themselves. They add them to playlists, and these playlists are nothing but these kind of videos. And so those playlists, once you get in there, because the playlist is nothing but that kind of content, when you go and watch one of those videos, all of the recommended videos are going to be similar. They're going to be kids in pools or at the beach or a slumber party or whatever. And so you've got a pedophile can just find one of these playlists. So what was happening is these pedophiles were gathering, sharing these playlists with each other. And so they were just creating one playlist after another, where it was the aggregate of all of these different videos, some definitely made by child traffickers and pornographers. But a lot of them are just, you know, innocent videos. So the average person who uploads to YouTube, you got to keep your kids out of this stuff. I mean, you really have to be careful. If you're not prepared for your child's image to be shown to pedophiles, you know, maybe the pedophiles would never come in contact with your child in real life. But still, do you want them, you know, fantasizing about your child at the, you know, very least? So it's, you have to be, parents have to be so careful with what they let their kids do on any social media, but especially YouTube. And parents themselves need to be very cautious about what they are going to put up as far as images of their own kids.
Where can people get that video now? Because is it still striked out on YouTube, so you have it somewhere else?
It was, and I uploaded it to VidMe, and it got a lot of views on VidMe right now. But today, VidMe is shutting down. That was the next platform that I was trying to build up on in case I ever get kicked off of YouTube, which I know is coming. It'll happen sooner or later. But VidMe is shutting down. So I'm going to start I have just started a new channel on BitChute, bitchute.com/morphonios, MORPHONIOS. And I don't have any videos on that channel yet because I just started it yesterday. But I will upload that YouTube video there. So if anyone wants to see that particular video, go to bitchute.com/morphonios, and I'll upload it today so that it'll be available there.
Now, when is VidMe shutting down?
Today. Today's their deadline, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, about a week ago, they announced that because they cannot compete with YouTube for advertising and the difficulty
That's
they've
too
been
bad.
Keeping it alive for a number of years now, but they just couldn't remain financially viable. So today is their last day.
Well, it's a sign that YouTube is a monopoly, right? When you can't have competing companies, they just can't make it. That means that there's a monopoly going on. That's too bad.
Yeah.
But at least we have some other smaller ones to deal with some of this. Let's get into the indictments. There's these mounting sealed indictments. Do you believe that it's a real deal, or do you think it's some kind of shell game situation?
Well, of course, we can only speculate, because who knows what's in all of these sealed indictments. And one of the questions, of course, is how many of the indictments are really connected to what's going on? Because the numbers range from dozens up to 9,000 or more indictments, depending on which source you look at. So I don't know how many are connected. I do think that it's going to be huge. I think that Mueller is real. His team is just, they're out for blood. They're going after everyone. But the problem is whether is how much of this is going to affect the president. The biggest thing they had, and I had predicted this was going to come out about 3 or 4 months before they started going after Paul Manafort. I had done a video saying, watch for it when the time comes. I had a conversation with my chiropractor. I'm laying there, and he's like, so what should I be looking for? Because we talk politics all the time, and I say, when you see Paul Manafort, the name Paul Manafort start coming out in the news, that's going to be big. Because if they decide that, if Mueller actually goes after Manafort, that signals that they are willing to throw their own people under the bus. Because despite Manafort having been Donald Trump's campaign chairman for a period of time, Manafort is a big time lobbying globalist. He's as dirty as they come, very dirty. And interesting thing, people don't even realize this. Paul Manafort, his lobbying firm, his partner was Rick Davis. Rick Davis was the campaign manager for John McCain back in 2008. So you've got Rick Davis managing John McCain's campaign, and then you've got his partner, Paul Manafort, who ends up getting installed as the chairman of Trump's campaign. And both of these men, Davis and Manafort, their lobbying firm, they were neck deep in activity with Russians, not with Vladimir Putin. You got to remember, Vladimir Putin has got a lot of his own domestic enemies. But McCain's guy, Davis, and Trump's guy, Manafort, they had a long history of dealing with Russian oligarchs, helping the globalists to take control of Ukraine from Russian control. A lot of dirty stuff. And McCain's tied to Oleg Deripaska, all these different Russian billionaires. Deripaska was a guy who was actually holding, I don't recall how many billions it was, but billions of dollars for, I believe it was Lord Jacob Rothschild. And when Deripaska ended up going to prison, Rothschild had to take his money back, you know, so it wouldn't get taken by the Russian government. So anyway, there is a connection between Russia and people tied to Donald Trump. It's just not the story.
Exactly.
That, you know, if there is a connection, but it's not the connection they're trying to see, that the media is trying to say. It's not that Donald Trump himself was colluding with Vladimir Putin or the Russian government. It's that some of the people that are connected to Trump's campaign were people that have a history working against Vladimir Putin, but they were Russians, and so there are connections to Russia, you could say, because of that. It's just a very different thing. So I always thought of it as they're so desperate to go after Donald Trump with this. If they decide to throw Paul Manafort under the bus, that means they're serious. That means that they don't have anything else, and they're willing to do anything, including going after some of their own high-profile people. And so Manafort, I'm sure, has been given a very, very sweet deal to roll on Trump, to say whatever. And all of the people linked to all this, it is going to be explosive. When all of this is unsealed and we start to see all the dominoes fall, I don't think we'll have seen anything like it in U.S. history as far as this kind of activity. I think it's going to be huge.
When do you think that might happen?
I don't know.
It's
I
hard to
just my
know.
my opinion. Yeah, it really. I think as long as Manafort, I'm sorry, as long as Mueller can continue to flip people, they're going to keep working at it. As long as they're, you get to a point where you can't flip any more big fish, and it's time to show your cards. But they're going to keep the, like round of poker. You just keep upping the ante each time. Keep going around, and so we'll see. I think that at this point, I think my opinion is Donald Trump probably should have fired Mueller a long time ago, but at this point, he can't do it. Politically, it would be like Nixon firing the special prosecutor during Watergate. At
You
this point, you
can't do
can't
it.
do that. You can't
No.
do it. He's stuck.
Yeah.
Whether or not it can take down Trump, I don't see how it can, but because these people just were not working for Trump. They weren't doing things on Trump's behalf that was shady. It's guilt by association. It depends on how much of it they can make it stick. And I think that Mueller's strategy here is, since there is no smoking gun, it's just the aggregate of, well, you've got this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, all these different people and all their little parts. And no, none of them are directly connected to you in a big way, but in totality, look at all these connections to you, and that may be enough to justify trying to indict Trump. I don't know.
Oh gosh, I really hope this turns into something good, all these indictments. As you know, we both know all the corruption that's going on, and really hope some of these pedophiles get nailed or
I
these. Go ahead.
hope so too. I really hope that, and there is a theory out there that is very enticing, and that is that that Robert Mueller all along has been on Trump's side, that the whole thing is a charade, the whole idea of going after Trump, that this is going to be the biggest bait and switch in U.S. political history, that all this time everyone thinks that Mueller's going after Trump, and I mean there is reason to there's substance to that. I can
I
see it.
hope
The
so.
people that they're going after, that's what's really started. When I've started hearing more and more about who they're going after, I keep thinking, wait a second, that's the wrong side. They're going after the wrong side if this is just a big witch hunt after Trump. So I'm not convinced either way at this point, but I'm very open to it, and I'm hopeful. That is my hope, like you. If tear these suckers down,
Oh gosh,
bring
yeah.
some justice. Let us have a victory for once, a big victory. We need it after all these years of the wrong side, and I mean the side of evil, those that are corrupt and doing the deep state, the shadow government, all this stuff, these bureaucrats. I would love to see a lot of these people go down and send the message that that will kind of revitalize the American people into believing again, into having hope again. Yes, we can get some control of our government back. That's my hope.
Well, will you stick around and answer a question for my patrons after we're
Sure.
done? Okay, great. And then how do people see your work? Where should they go?
The best way to find me is on my YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/prepare 333. The name of the channel is End Times News Report. Sometimes you find it when you search for it in the YouTube search box, but even the name of my channel they suppress, so sometimes it's hard to find. But it's youtube.com/prepare333. If you go to Facebook, it's facebook.com/endtimesnewsreport.
Well, thank you so much. You're doing such great work, and I just recommend everybody to check out what you're doing. Just great.
Thanks. Thanks, Sarah. I always love talking with you. You're lots of fun.